I'm a troubadour, baby, just a singer with a song.
Hey, and here we go. Welcome to a new edition of We Talk Music. I'm Brett, and I'm happy to be joined by my co-host, Mo. How's it going?
It's okay. You didn't introduce yourself as the King of the Casters.
Oh, that's right, Mr. Brett Podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm, of course, the Crown Prince of Charisma. How are you intimidated yet, Derek?
Yeah, I'm wondering if I'm the king of something or prince of something too.
Ooh, well that's good. We can
come up with something before the end of the show.
Yeah, that's right. Anyways, we are super happy to be joined by the multi-talented Derek Davis from Derek Davis and the Revolutionary Souls. We got Moonshine. We got, American
Blues Box.
Blues Box. And, of course, where we know you from, Babylon AB. Derek, happy to have you on.
Right on. Thank you, man. I'm happy to be here.
So let's see now. Why don't we start talking about the new Babylon AD album? That one's coming out, November?
Yeah, it's scheduled for release November 10th on Frontier SO. Our records. They're an Italy, Italian label, but they have, you know, basically all the last standing rock bands. They've got Def Leppard, Tesla, YNT, Mr. Big, you know, list goes on and on and on. And what happened was about a month and a half ago, we had just finished up our record, and we had a German distribution going to do worldwide distribution for us. And you know, we were just going to put it out ourselves with the worldwide distribution. And they asked us if we could hear the record before we did anything with it. So I sent it over to Frontiers, and they really, really were blown away. They got back to me within like 2 hours, and they said, please don't sign with anybody else. We want to sign you guys to a two-album deal. So, you know, a few weeks went by, and we signed the deal. So we're going to make a video, and we're going to do some dates in Europe. And things are looking up. The record is really super cool. It's called Revelation Highway. And it's got some great songs on there, man. Really, really super cool songs.
Well, if the songs are anything like the newer stuff that you've been working on, then, I mean, that stuff's fantastic. So, absolutely, we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, go ahead. No, you said the stuff I've been working on. Are you referring to the Revolutionary Soul album?
Yeah, both the Revolutionary Souls and Revolt. I know that obviously Babylon AD.
Well, you know, this is more in line like the first album meets Revolt, I would say, actually, in a way. The coolest thing is that John Matthews was the original founding member of the band, along with me and Jamie. Back in, 88, 87, whatever the hell it was. And Dan didn't want to make a record. Dan De La Rosa, our other guitar player, he didn't want to make a record. He was just too busy with life. You know, he's got two kids and he's coaching baseball and all this kind of stuff. And he just said, man, I just don't have any time to play anymore, you know. So we asked John if he wanted to rejoin the band. And sure enough, that sparked put a fire under the ass of the band. And we just started writing continuously. And we pulled out some old stuff that I had written with John years ago and just listened to it and said, wow, this, you know, that a lot of people had told us over the years, you guys should do this song, you should do this song, you know, that kind of thing. And we've got a few of those songs that we've had for a long time, you know, but we redid them and modernized them and made them harder and heavier. And the record is really, really super good. And I'm glad that John Matthews is back in the band. It's just a real, really cool sound that we got going on, you know, very melodic and very, it's just really cool. I think everybody's going to really, really, really super like it.
Well, that's great. Now, you said you had a two album deal. Is that kind of normal for a band nowadays or is that lucky?
I'm not sure. I think most labels sign to a one album deal, the two album deal. I don't know. Ours is actually a two album / three album deal. If everything goes good with two albums and they release a third album, and then they have extended contracts to see if we, you know, we want to keep on working. But, you know, we're supposedly putting out a record every 2 years, you know, so we'll see what happens. And if we, you know, if we still like working with the label, then we'll keep doing it. If not, then we'll figure something else out, you know?
Yeah, that'd be fantastic because I know that so many bands nowadays, it's, you don't see that many new albums from some bands. They mostly just go in and tour.
Yeah, I know that most people still don't write anymore, and I don't really get that because I'm continuously writing, you know, like the Revolutionary Soul album that I just put out, which is mainly like an R&B kind of record, you know. I mean, I'm just always, as an artist, you know, I'm always creating all the time, so I don't understand how people lose their creative juices. I just don't really get that, you know. But no, I mean, we've already got six songs. Valentine Gill already has six songs ready for the next record. You know, and that's not going to be released for another 2 years. So in the meantime, we'll probably write another 20 songs by then. You know, so we'll see what the best 10 or 12 songs are for the next one. But, you know, I'm really happy with what happened with Revolutionary Soul. I just got I was nominated for best R&B and soul artist by L.A. Music Critic Awards. And I won. And I was
pumped
on that, you know, because I'm known as a rock singer, you know what I mean? But, yeah, that was that just happened last week, and I was pretty blown away. I was like, wow, best R&B artist? That sounds cool to me.
Yeah, you'll take it. Especially true. We were listening to that album ourselves, you know, and there's a singer, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Grayson Hugh. And
what's his name?
Grayson Hugh. And you sound so remarkably. He's a long time blues, you know, soul singer.
Wow.
And you sound so remarkably similar to him. And we're like, you just nailed the sound. You just, you know, because
I'm gonna have to check that guy out. I haven't heard of him.
You haven't heard of him? Well, let me tell you something. You guys, you do a duet, and we'll if we can figure out which is which, then you buy us a beer.
Wow, I need to hear this guy.
Yeah, I know. Let me tell you something. He's a hell of a singer. I think you'll like him.
Wow.
He probably
sounds good. I like anybody that has a soulful voice.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's that blue-eyed soul kind of feel, and he's probably a little, you know, like you've probably got a little more growl, but no, there were moments where it was just like, wow, that's almost uncanny. And you know, that I mean, in my opinion, that's high praise for
moving longtime fans of him, so absolutely. When I heard the style of that record, because I mean, I come off Revolt, and I thought Revolt, I mean, I was thinking to myself, I couldn't decide, you know, Revolt or American Blues Box. For me, I was thinking those are maybe my two favorite things you've done, and that and the original album, Babylon AD, and then I hear this, and I'm like, wow, you know, he sounds so much like Grayson Hugh or somebody. So it's nice to see somebody like you. I mean, you're exploring so many different things, and you already talked about that a little bit, but for me, that's, you know, I mean,
yeah,
that's it. I mean, well, you make the music for us, but you make it for yourself too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I make it, you know, I make it for my friends and my wife, just, you know, people around me. And I've got a recording studio in my house, so I'm in here right now just because I thought it'd be a little bit more quieter, you know. And it just gets your juices flowing, to keep writing. You know, you're looking at these really cool monitors and all this recording equipment. You're like, geez, man, yeah, I got to do something with it, you know. So I just like writing, you know, and I like exploring different types of music, you know. I mean, I've even got almost a full-length album of, believe it or not, Nine Inch Nails type of stuff.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. Okay, that's different, too.
Well, it's cool, I suppose.
But, you know, I'm not sure if I want to throw that out there, because people might say, what the hell are you trying to do, you know?
I suppose that if you look at
experimenting.
American Blitzkrieg, and if you were to take it to the nth degree, maybe that's the Nine Inch Nails. But
I just like so many different types of music, except for probably country and rap. Those are the two stuff I don't really like, but everything else I really dig. Folk music, anything, you know.
Yeah, we get that.
Who knows? I might make a folk record. I mean, I've made a blues record. I made a southern blues record, a semi-soul record, enough rock records. So, you know, something else is in the works.
Nice.
That's right. Cover all
that. You got to keep challenging yourself, right? You got to keep challenging yourself unless music becomes boring. I couldn't imagine just me writing rock songs, you know, two ballads per album and just a heavy rock song and just basically repeating yourself over and over and over again, you know, and you're on your 10th album now, but you just still sound like the first one and you're still singing the same stuff, you know. It's kind of boring to me, you know.
Was that always your kind of your point of view? Or I mean, because I mean, you go from your first Babylon AD and then your second Babylon AD album, and it's years before you guys do American Blitzkrieg, and like were you always just kind of like, oh, I want to experiment, I want to try something new? Were you pushing the band in those early days to try something new between the albums, or how do you kind of look at that?
Well, the way I look at what happened between the Babylon AD after we got dropped from Arista, you know, the famous Nirvana band that killed the industry for us all, about 93, you know, I hooked up with the guys in Moonshine and I was playing blues. I started doing, you know, the American Blues Box, and I did the Moonshine stuff and things like that. And then I just got tired of the music business, per se, is how it was back in the late 90s and early, you know, probably late 90s. I thought I was going to quit, you know. And I actually didn't play music, man, for probably 2 or 3 years, even though I'd write a song here and there. I don't know, you know, and maybe because I got married and I had a young child, and it just seemed like, well, I guess music's over for me, you know. And then the guys wanted to put together another record, so Dan had some guitar stuff, you know, some really cool riffs and everything. And I said, well, you know, let's put out another Babylon AD record, see what it takes us. And that's kind of what happened there, you know. And then after that, I just kept wanting to experiment, you know, I don't know. That's the gist of it.
So I'm interested actually in like what that mindset is like when you're kind of thinking that you're done with music. Like what does that feel like to you? You know, I mean, now as you look back on it, did it feel like maybe a part of you would go missing?
You want to know the craziest story?
Yes.
You guys are the only person that got this scoop. when I basically gave up on music, you know what I was or started to become before I quit? I was an Oakland police officer.
No shit.
For about a good, you know, I went through the training and everything, and I was there just for a month or so, and I just said, I can't do this. I must be out of my mind. And my mom and my father and my, you know, all my family and my wife were all just saying, like, what are you doing? How could you, you know, give up music and become a police officer, you know? And I was like, this, you know, when I was a little kid, that's what I wanted to be. But as soon as I was on the Oakland streets for just a very short time, I just said, holy shit, I must be out of my mind. They're right. And I tell you what, man, as soon as I resigned, I ran back to the studio and started writing, like, furiously. You know what I mean? I said, I'm a musician. What the hell am I thinking?
I can't imagine. Like, it absolutely strikes me as one of those things that...
Oh, yeah, I cut off all my hair, you know. I was just a straight, like, dude, like, just totally, like, you know, law enforcement, you know. I must have been nuts.
The funny thing is,
they hired me, you know.
Well, I'm listening to you say that, and I'm thinking to myself, what's he going to say? You know, I'm thinking, is he going to say, like, something like dentist? Like, what's he... I tell you what I didn't see coming was police officer. Yeah. He's like, where is he going with this? Yeah, crazy.
In Oakland.
Yeah, in Oakland, yeah, exactly. That's not that.
That's why everyone thought I was absolutely nuts.
Yeah, that's taking your life in your hands, that city.
I've still got a couple buddies that are there, and they got some terrible stories that they could tell sometimes. And, you know, I'm like, man, I don't even want to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. So life's good.
That's cool over there.
Tell me kind of the reception from the fans as you guys announced this album compared to when you announced American Blitzkrieg. Is it kind of the same? Is it different? What's kind of the feedback you're getting?
Because... Oh, no. Well, you know, back then when the last time we made a full length studio album, I mean, that was what, 16, something like that, years ago, whatever, you know? And you know, the internet wasn't up like it is now, and word about, you know, they didn't have Facebook and all that other stuff. So, and we didn't really have a major label behind us or anything like that. So, of course, it's extremely different, you know, than it was back then. And in some ways, I think it's just a lot easier now than it was in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2005, you know, just because the internet is so ingrained in everybody now, so everybody can find news and find music just at the tip of their fingers in 1 second just by popping in a band's name. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. We're always connected now, every minute, right?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So you've been getting then lots of feedback from the fans. What are they saying to you guys?
Well, so far everything, I think they just announced it a couple of days ago or something, because Frontier said they haven't officially announced it. They're supposed to do that later this week, but they put out a couple of blurbs and stuff like that. And just from the blurbs that I've seen, everybody's, that is still a Babble NED fan is just like, I can't wait, this is going to be great, man. I've been looking forward to this for so long, that kind of stuff. So, we're pretty psyched about it, and the record really is good, guys. Man, it's not just like, oh, there's two good songs and the rest of them suck. It's like, there's seven good songs, and the other three are like, those are good songs. They're not a hits, but they're like, shit, that's a good song. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's no filler on this record, really. There isn't. And the people that are close friends of ours, or critiquers of ours that we trust their opinions, they're all saying the same thing. Whoa, man, you guys got like a masterpiece, but how's it ever going to get out there to be a masterpiece? Because nowadays marketing and promotion and stuff is just not the same as it used to be. It's like, well, I don't know, but we'll just put our best foot forward and try to go with it. But we've had nobody say, I don't know, man, you guys might want to throw a couple more songs on there because you don't really have a hit on there. Everybody's saying like, man, you guys got three or four hits on that song if you could get to radio, So
now is
we'll
it,
see what happens,
Yeah. Is it easier maybe nowadays because you don't have quite the same pressure? I can imagine in the early days, a lot of label pressure, you're out touring all the time, you've got to write certain songs, you've got to do certain things.
Yeah, that's a little part of it. I think for me as a songwriter, though, which everybody tells me, and I do believe it myself, even if they weren't telling me that, I'm just way better singer and a way better songwriter than I was back then. Back then I was still kind of learning, when you're young, you're still learning how to format a song and see where it takes you. And now it seems it's a lot easier for me to write songs, to think up melodies faster than I used to think up cooler lyrics and stuff and take a listener on a different journey than just, bang your head kind of stuff or whatever, I just really think that some people don't seem like they advance. They just stay the same as they were. You know what I mean? And that goes for singers, guitar players, drummers, bassists. I know most of my friends and family, they're all musicians, but some people just don't seem like they ever kind of keep learning. I guess they maybe give up at a certain learning curve or something, or get lazy maybe. I don't know, but I'm like, like we were talking earlier, I'm always trying to explore something different, like the blues. Like when I started playing the blues, I picked up a slide guitar. I didn't know I had no clue how to play slide guitar. I didn't know nothing, right? So I said, well, how am I going to learn how to play slide guitar? So I picked up like Elmore James, Sunhouse, all the greats that were in the 40s. And that's all I did for 3 years, man. I just listened to that old stuff and I just got that same guitar tone. And I just, read everything I possibly can about the blues. And then I had a killer blues band, I had a harmonica player and a piano player. And it's just like the band was kick ass. It wasn't some like white guy playing the blues. I mean, it sounded like with 1960 at Elmore James' house or something. It was really stomping, And then I started going like more rock with it as time went on and stuff like that. Rock blues, kind of like early Aerosmith stuff. But like I said, I just immersed myself in that and taught myself how to play the slide guitar, instead of just the traditional guitars. And I think a lot of guitar players and stuff, and guys I know that they could out shred me any day of the week. But if I pick up a slide guitar and I start playing it for them, they go, oh shit, how do you do that? I'm like, well, it's not that hard, dude. All you had to do is put in a year or two just to figure it out, So.
No, and I can see that, I think there are people who they become really happy with where they're at. They're good with that, and that they don't need to go further. They're just satisfied.
Right, it's kind of like work to them or something like that, and I don't see it as work to me. Every time I pick up a guitar or start playing keyboards or something like that, it's not work to me, I like it. I have fun. It's like maybe if a basketball player you know, it wasn't even professional, but just like play basketball every day. You know, guys at the gym, you see the same damn guys every day playing basketball. Well, they're not pro, but that's what they like to do. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing with me. It's not work. It's fun. You know?
Yeah, we saw a concert recently. I'm not going to say who it is, but one of your peers. And, you know, I mean, there's no question. We're watching him. We're like, it's a good show. He can still sounds great when he's singing. But there's no question, like, you're watching him. This is the routine he does every night. Moment for moment, every second, and it is his job. And he's doing his job. And he's good at his job. But there definitely wasn't that energy and that sense of, I don't know, something from him to the audience was missing.
It doesn't seem like they're hungry anymore. They're just sitting back on the laurels. I see it all the time, man, all the time. But I don't say nothing or say, you know, I just say, well, whatever, man, that's your trip. It's not mine.
Exactly.
I just want to keep getting...
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, in this case, it's all about you. And I mean, and I got to be honest, you know, the first Babylon AD album, I mean, that's one of those albums that I go back to when I want to listen to something like that. You know, I'm going right back there because it's one of my favorites of that time.
Yeah, well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I do the same thing you guys do, you know, different bands that I grew up on and stuff like that. I mean, I go back to the first two Aerosmith albums all the time.
Yeah.
Why am I listening to a song that I've heard a million times? I don't know. I still like it. You know what I mean? It still kicks my ass. So there are certain bands. I know exactly what you guys are talking about, man, where you just kind of go back. There might have been 50 bands released that year, but for some reason, there's only one or two you keep going back to, you know?
That's true. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's why we're excited. I mean, we grew up when this stuff was... when that type of music was the thing in high school, right? And we still love it, and we want to hear it, and we want to hear fresh stuff from it. And it's not really out there as much anymore, right? So, I mean, the idea of somebody giving us that again, it's really exciting to us.
You know, though, what kind of strikes me is I do hear some of the newer stuff that's coming out by bands, you know, and I'm not naming anybody, but I'm just saying I do hear the newer stuff that's coming out by some of the bands that were around, like when we were around. And I got to tell you, man, I listen to four or five songs and I'm like searching for a song that's like, even like in the wheelhouse is like, that's pretty good song. You know what I mean? It's like, what? That song is not good. I don't even think that could make their first album or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I personally, I don't want to do that, man. When our album comes out, I want people to go, holy shit, man, that song kicks ass, you know? So when we were writing this record, it was like, there's no way we're writing just some filler songs just to put a record out. There's no freaking way. You know what I mean? So, but it's just weird to see some of these artists that are, you know, pretty semi-big, and you listen to two of their singles or something, you're going, that's not a single, man. I don't know what you guys are thinking. You know what I mean? Because a song, you should have that song should hit you by at least the second time you hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's like, whoa, you know what I mean? But there's still a lot of cheesy lyrics out there, and you know, people just doing the same old stuff over and over again. So, you know, I like to just harden it up and this album still has the exact same Babylon AD song, but it's just better, man.
You know, awesome.
It's as good as the first album. I always thought the first album was really good. I like the second album, but I thought the first album was stronger, you know?
I'd agree with you, definitely. Yeah. I mean, for us, the first album is the one that we go back and listen to.
Well, because again, those songs just stick with you.
Yeah, the second album has some cool songs, you know, So Savage of Heart and Redemption, but it really didn't, it just didn't have enough power that the first album had. I think that had to do with a lot of a record company meddling on their second album. They meddled in everything, man. They just, you know, but, you know, that's the way it was back in those days. You know, everybody wanted to get your hands on you and try to turn you into something you weren't, you know?
Yeah, if we can go into that a little more, I kind of like, I mean, you guys come out there in 89. I think that's when the first album was released, right?
Yeah, it was released in November 1st of 89, right on the cusp, you know, of 90. Yeah.
And so you released that album, and, you know, you guys, when that album gets released, it does well. It's you know, but it's not the mega hit. But you guys seem poised.
Right.
Like, you guys seem like you had the songs, you had the look, you had the talent, you had lots of airplay on MTV. You know, Sam Kinison, we'll probably get there a little bit later. You know, RoboCop coming up and all this stuff. Like
yeah.
you guys seem poised to be the next band to go to that level of the superstar tier. And so we go from that and then to the second album. And what is it then that you think, you talk about the interference. What is it kind of the journey, like the band's journey from, you know, 89 to what, 92 was it that this next album came out?
Yeah, the next album came out in 92. Well, you know, the first album did really, really well and everything like that. And you're right, I did feel that. But I kind of always thought that we were like a year and a half behind the curve. Because, so for instance, like when Tesla got their record deal in 86 or 85, I think it was, we were playing the same clubs. We were like rivaling with those guys in all the clubs. And I felt that, and we were just coming up. We were just starting, like, you know, and they were called City Kid. I don't know if you guys remember that.
They were called
City Kid. So I guess they got their first album came out maybe 87, because we'd only been together about 6 months or something like that. And you know, we play with them sometimes, and we play other clubs, and they play other clubs. But, you know, I thought they were a really good band. I was like, oh, man, they got a record deal right on. And then record labels started coming and seeing us, and they kept saying, you guys are almost there, but you're just a little too green. And I don't know, man. I always just felt, man, if somebody would have just signed us in 87 or even 88, we would have had a little bit better shot, because by the time of the end of 89, right when 90 started, everybody else got the same thing. Now there's another 100 cookie-cutter bands. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was really hard to get traction after 1990 to be stand out from the crowd of everybody's got long hair and everybody's got a lead guitar playing, you know, and everybody's singing about chicks or whatever. You know, it was just really hard to try to stand out, you know, with Motley Crue going on and Guns N' Roses and stuff. I mean, how many of those kind of bands can you have, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have so many. And Arista, the label that we were signed to, they were, you know, they didn't have any rock bands, so they didn't have any rock promotion department. Like Geffen had a strong rock department, so almost any band that Geffen signed, you knew you were going to get radio airplay. You know what I mean? You knew you were going to get massive MTV airplay and stuff like that. Because they had that was their forte, was rock, you know. And Arista's was, their forte was Kenny G and Whitney Houston. You know what I mean? So where were we going to be, you know? We're just the rock band, just to say that they got a rock band, kind of like, that's what it felt like. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean,
like,
everybody
else has got a rock band, we got to get one too, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because I mean, I know we've seen that story before, where it's just like, you know, the label goes out and they get one rock band, and then maybe that does well, and then they go all rock bands, and then of course the next big thing comes out, and then they get the one, and then they dump all the rock bands and then move over to the next big thing. So
yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that they're business guys, I guess that's what you got to do if you're, you know, if you're not just doing it because you love music, but you're just a business guy, well, then that's what you do, you know. Arista was owned by BMG, I think. I mean, they're gigantic conglomerate. You know, they could give a rat's ass about us, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's bottom line. It's all about the numbers at a certain point, and that's unfortunate.
That's right.
So is that kind of,
yeah.
If you were to look at the bands that just achieved that crazy, huge status, is there some thing that you can say that they all had this or they all had that? Is there some defining characteristic that you think that they had, or is it a timing, a lot of that?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, some of them just got lucky for the timing, because some guys I know, they can't play with shit, and they got
all right,
they went
off air,
like,
you can give
I'm still amazed sometimes, you know. That guy can't sing with a damn. How the hell did he even get in the band? He's got a platinum record. What? You know, you're thinking to yourself in your head, you know. But so that's the timing part, probably. Or they just got such a big, just a fat, cheesy song, you know.
Yeah.
That at the time, it was like, that's what everybody wanted to hear, you know, just the big hair and the party or something. But, no, there are some bands that you know, stood out from that period. You know, Whitesnake definitely stood out. I mean, you know, I can name probably five or six where I'd say, well, those guys really deserve to make it. Guns N' Roses, you know, stuff like that. But there's a lot of bands that, like, I would never name, but that I'm still miffed, and they might be miffed that we ever got a deal too. You know, you know, they might think the same thing about us. I don't know. you know. But you know, the way I grew up in—I mean, truthfully, guys, I grew up in like R&B, and then I got into rock. You know what I mean? So my forte was like Al Green, Marvin Gaye, James Brown, you know, the Ohio Players, stuff like that. And then I noticed that, well, there aren't any soul guys around here, and I'm the only one singing soul. I guess I better start playing Lynyrd Skynyrd and Led Zeppelin. You know what I mean? So I always go back to the singing ability and songwriting ability. And my songwriting was always like, I always thought, man, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, those guys know how to write songs, you know? So growing up, I was more like wanting to be a singer, songwriter, artist, but that could do stuff good, you know? And I think a lot of people just kind of, they might do stuff good, but they don't have any kind of foundation. Maybe they grew up, you know, I don't know, you know, just listening to one style of music and that's it. So that's all they know how to write. And that's all they know how to do. The one trick pony type of thing, you know? But, yeah, I mean, it's just everything's subject to opinion, though, man. You know, I could be sitting here talking and somebody hear my interview and go, that guy's full of shit, which is cool, you know. But that's just my opinion, you know.
That's right. Well, and in our opinion, you know, we love the music. We love Babylon AD, so it's all good, right?
We'll see when we release the record about what you guys think. You guys definitely got to get back when they call me up or whatever. Maybe when they give their advanced copies out, I can get one to you or something.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Absolutely. Yeah, we'd love to review it.
Okay, cool. That sounds like a plan.
So you guys started out in San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
And
well,
then you...
Not San Francisco. It was actually... Oakland, Hayward, and Fremont. And
okay.
We did a lot of our stuff, yeah, which is outside San Francisco.
Yes. Just,
you know, when you tell somebody where you're from, they don't know where the hell Fremont is or, you know. So more like Oakland area.
And so then at a certain point, you came to L.A. and started working there.
Yeah.
What was, like, part of the reasoning and then also what was the difference? Because, of course, you know, the Sunset Strip scene was so crazy.
Yeah. So what happened was we were in the Bay Area, and we just kind of like became the kings of the Bay Area. Like everywhere we played, that place would be sold out. You know, we'd play the Stone and the Keystone and the Omni, all the big clubs that were the biggest clubs around here for about a year and a half or whatever. And the record labels would come out, and somebody would offer us, let's say MCA or something, would say, well, we'll give you a $5,000 demo to do or something. Or somebody else would say something else. You know, well, we'll give you this or whatever. But our manager kept saying, no, 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 we're holding out. We're just going to keep on holding out. So Clive Davis came and saw us at a show in San Francisco. And him and I were backstage and we were talking, right? And so he wanted to set me up with the songwriter. And the funny thing is, the songwriter happened to be, what's his name from Bryan Adams?
Jim Balance?
Yeah, Jim Balance. So Jim Balance was with him, you know, and Jim Balance and me were going to start writing. But, you know, I'm like, man, this isn't Babylon AD, you know, but I don't know. So it kind of started developing a relationship between me and Clive a little bit, you know. And so he said, Dirk, you know, you guys just aren't ready right now this second. He goes, but if you keep honing your craft in another 3 months or 6 months, I want to see you again. So then what happened was we played some more gigs and everything. And I started writing with Jack Pawnee. I don't know if you know who Jack Pawnee is, but he's a really well-respected hard rock and guitarist that's a songwriter.
Yeah, for sure. Totally.
You know, Alice Cooper and I don't know, Bon Jovi, Warrant, Cinderella. I mean, almost you name it. He's always has a seems like a track on almost every rock band's album, you know. So I flew out to New Jersey and I wrote six songs with them, and they were all really super good songs. Some of them landed on the record, like Hammer Swings Down and Kid Goes Wild landed on the record, and I think one other one, Desperate, maybe, I can't remember. But anyways, so as soon as I did that, I came back to the Bay Area, and you know, I taught the band, here's our demos, man, check these out. You know, they were a little bit pissed off a little bit because they weren't writing, but I was the main songwriter anyways. But you know, I could see their point a little bit, you know. But the songs are such great songs. It's like, who gives a shit who writes them or co-writes with, or I'm co-writing with, you know what I mean? So, then our manager just said, look, man, let's just move down to L.A. and try to conquer L.A. like we did San Francisco. So we said, okay. We moved down to L.A. There was seven of us. There was five guys in the band, and then we had a road manager and a guitar tech. And we had a one-bedroom apartment at the St. James over in right off of Hollywood, right down the strip. I mean, and it was like you guys said, it was pretty crazy back then. It was mayhem day in and day night, man. One day coming over, guys. And chicks just everywhere and just party everywhere. And the guys in Guns N' Roses lived there, and we rehearsed with Guns N' Roses. We shared their studio with them, you know. So it was just like, oh, man, this is heaven to us, you know. And I swear we were there probably for less than a week. And Clive called up our manager and said, I want to see the guys tomorrow. And we hadn't even practiced since we'd been down there. All we did was get our equipment there and we just partied every night, you know. And we said, oh, shit. What are we going to do, you know? So we rented a rehearsal studio. I think it was SIR Studios, whatever. We went to the studio. We practiced all day before Clive came. You know, he was coming, showing at 2 o'clock or something. We were down there at 8 o'clock in the morning. We practiced about, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours away before he got there. And by the time he got there, he had 3 or 4 other A&R guys with him from New York. And he sat on the couch. And he said, okay, boys, play for me. And we were up on a big stage, you know. And we said, okay. So we played 7 songs, and as soon as we hit our last note, we kind of like looked at them for a second. You know, we had to put on a concert, like you know, we're in front of 1,000 people or something, and here's 3 or 4 guys in suits just sitting on a couch like 10 feet away from us. You know what I mean? So it was pretty crazy. But, yeah, as soon as we got done, he jumped up and just said, welcome to the family, boys. And we just looked at each other, and we said, really? He said, you got a record deal. We're going to start getting the contracts ready. You know, it was a pretty cool high. You know, coming from Clive, because he was definitely, you know, like a music mogul, you know, if you guys know his story and everything. I mean, he signed everybody, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Janis Joplin, Santana, you know, and to Aerosmith, to know that we were like, you know, and he kept telling me, right, he goes, Derek, I'm going to make you the next Aerosmith. So I'm believing all this shit. You know? I'm like, all right, really? But, you know, one thing, just the music business, it is what it is, man. It eats its own, you know. So, but, yeah, that's pretty much how we got down to Los Angeles, and then we lived a life of mayhem for a good 5 years or whatever, you know, before we got dropped.
But, you know, I mean, is the Sunset Strip in that era and that craziness, is it almost like...
Oh, yeah.
Is it almost like it's so like was it so great that even if you don't get mega rich and mega fame and like is it just being there and in that scene and that time is it like just was it that amazing?
Yeah, a lot of good memories, man. It wasn't just the Sunset Strip. Hollywood Boulevard was awesome too, man. But you know, and the Sunset Strip, you had Gazzari's and the whiskey and everything was there, you know. And what was weird about it was, like, after a while, after you lived there for so long, because I lived in Los Angeles myself for about 7 years, even after the band relocated back home, pretty soon you don't even go out on a Friday and Saturday night because it's just mayhem. You know, there's traffic stopped on Sunset Boulevard, people getting out of their cars right in the middle of the street, and police everywhere and shit going on where it's just like, you know, it's Saturday and Fridays, I get home a lot, you know. And the other days, at least you could walk around a little bit, you know, and move, you know, go down to Rainbow or whatever and have dinner instead of wait outside in some line down the street, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was really fun and really crazy and, you know, a lot of great parties up in the hills and met a lot of people, man, that just like when I was a kid just would never believe that I met this person, I met that person, or I'm at this person's house. How the hell did I get here? You know, kind of pinch yourself.
Give us a couple of those names.
Yeah. What's that?
Give us a couple of those names, you know?
Well, okay, yeah, I guess it's not bad, right? But, I mean,
no.
Like, okay, like Michael Shanker, I ended up at one of his houses one time at a big party with me and Mitch Perry. I'm sure you guys probably know who Mitch Perry is, but Mitch Perry was a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
So, and he played with Michael Shanker. So, you know, next thing I know, I'm up there partying with Michael Shanker all the time. I'm like, what the hell is this? This is crazy.
That's great.
When I was a kid, Michael Shanker was the baddest guitar player in the world. And then, you know, James Lomenzo was a really good friend of mine. And he played with White Lion. And he was playing with Zach Wilde at the time, you know. And I didn't know Zach from Adam. And then we started hanging out. And the next thing I know, I'm always at Zach's house hanging out. You know, shit like that, you know. you know, and then you go to a bar or whatever, and my wife worked at a really super cool club down there called Spice, and that's where everybody, all the movie stars hung out there. And I'd be sitting there eating, and rubbing elbows with, to my left is Sylvester Stallone, and we're just talking shit like regular dudes, and to my right's like Tone Loc.
Fantastic.
We're just sitting there talking like regular dudes. We're all in the industry somehow. But, you know, you kind of pinch yourself going, this is fucking crazy. You know what I mean? So it was a lot of that kind of stuff. And after a while, it wears off. It's, oh, yeah, okay. Oh, wow, I was just talking to Rod Stewart. Wow, what a trip that is, man, you know? But after a while, it just kind of just goes out of your mind like any big deal. But then, you know, 10, 20 years later, you start thinking about it like, was I really sitting there talking to Rod Stewart for a half hour at one time? You know what I mean?
That's crazy, yeah.
So, it's crazy because, like, when you're a kid, you're thinking of all these movie stars and all these, you know, rock stars and stuff. That's, wouldn't it be awesome to meet this person or whatever? And then here you are, you know? So, yeah, it's a crazy time, man.
How about some of the things that are associated with the Sunset Strip, like pay for play and flyering and just these type of things?
Have you
experienced any of that?
No, we've never had to pay to play, but I mean, most bands, I guess, had to. I don't know. I've never paid to play in my life. I wouldn't do it. But I do remember, I guess you could say, the day the music died. I do remember that. In Los Angeles, they passed an ordinance that no band could put up any more flyers in the city. That they couldn't put up a flyer, and if they did put up a flyer, that the police were going to find who they were and give them like a, you know, misdemeanor ticket of $500 or something like that. And I swear, man, as soon as that happened, flyers went down. And if Gazzari's and that Sunset Strip used to have, let's say, 5,000 people on a Saturday night, it was down to 1,200 people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was weird. It was so weird, man. It was just like in a day, by the time people started understanding what was going on, you know, it just kind of vanished, man. It just, you know, got to become like it's a Sunday night or something because you couldn't put flyers up. You couldn't advertise your bands, you know. And before that, every band was walking up and down the street with flyers everywhere. They were in the street, they were on poles, and the chicks were everywhere, and they had flyers and pictures, and everybody was going to be somebody, you know. And then all of a sudden, it was like, hell, I'm not putting up a flyer. I'm not going to give a handout. I'm not going to tell anybody about my gig. I might get in trouble, you know. So...
Well, there's probably so
that
much
really
competition.
That really killed the LA music scene really big, really fast.
Yeah, it's amazing. But you know, because I can imagine there was just so much competition that it was almost like if you didn't know who was playing, you know, where do you go? And do you just stop going?
Yeah. Yeah, and by that time I was so saturated. I mean, you know, you probably wouldn't know if you were from out of town who was a real musician, who wasn't, because there were so many poser guys that some of them weren't even musicians, but they looked like it. You know, they looked like rock stars.
Yeah,
you know,
for
walking
sure.
Up and down the street with maybe the flyers for their friend's band, you know, you wouldn't know. So it was crazy.
No, I mean, you know, as a whole, like, we're fascinated by that scene and by that era, you know, just because it was such a, you know, such a microcosm of unreality at that.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Because you could be
being around that age, you know, when you're very impressionable and you're in your early 20s, you know, you're just blown away by everything, you know?
Yeah. And I guess you're down there and you got the party scene, you got the music, you also had the comedy clubs. I mean, I think Sam, obviously, and Pauly Shore is another person that I think we kind of associate with that scene. I don't know, were there others that were kind of down there also?
Yeah, I remember seeing Chris Rock the first time ever.
It was
at the comedy club. I think he was 16 years old or something.
Wow.
And me and my wife went down there, and he was nobody. He wasn't nobody. And we just, you know, let's go to the comedy club and have something to eat and watch these guys, this guy, you know, or watch whoever was there. And it was instantly, man. I turned to my wife within 5 minutes and said, holy shit, this guy's going to be a superstar. And she goes, I know, who is this guy? We'd never heard of him. Nobody had ever heard of him. But it was, like, obvious. And he was about 15, 16 years old. And I was like, oh, my God, that guy's going to be a superstar. Sure enough, about 5 years later, you know, he's shining his shoes.
So, Sam Kinison, how did you guys kind of, you know, hook up and start your friendship?
what happened with Sam is when we were making the first record, he was making his record at the same time in one of the studios, and Robert Palmer was making his record in one of the studios. Those three recording, actually there was four, and Slaughter was making their record, so there was four studios. Might have been the Grinder or something like that. I can't remember exactly where it was, but so you know, we've seen him every day, and pretty soon we started kind of partying with him, and you know, he stayed late. I mean, I wouldn't say every day, because he didn't get to probably about 7 o'clock at night, and then he'd stay till about 7 o'clock in the morning. So, and then, you know, and we'd hang out sometimes, or be at the Rainbow or something like that, and have a drink with him and everything. But, so it just kind of developed, you know, a little bit of a friendship. You know, he was, you know, doing a lot of the other stuff at one time, and he asked me if I would sing on one of his songs. It was actually the Rolling Stones song. I think it was Under My Thumb. Yeah. So I said, yeah, but if I sing on your song, you got to sing on my song. He goes, I can't fucking sing. And he goes, don't matter, man. I got a part in my head that I think you could do, you know, because at the breakdown, I always thought we should have something there, you know. And I had nothing written there, but I always kind of thought something would be really cool at the breakdown besides sirens and stuff, you know. And the kid goes, well, so as soon as I was done, he said, what time you want me over? And I said to myself, well, I got to write some kind of script up in about an hour. I'm thinking, why don't you come over at 2? You know, he said, okay, I'll be there at 2. So, and like I said, we were all in the same recording studios. You know, he was in studio A, we were in studio B or whatever. So sure enough, he came over and, you know, we were drinking and just having a good time. And he said, okay, what do you got? So we put on the track. And he's looking at the lyrics, looking at my words that I had written for him. And I kind of told him how I wanted it done. Like, you know, oh, you cop. Da, 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 da. He was like, yeah, I got you. I don't got to read no more shit. And I said, all right, right on. You know, and I swear, man, I think it was just me and the producer and two of the guys in the band, you know, by that time, they were in the control booth. And he just got in front of the mic and he just belted out. And second take, it was just 100%. He just threw his hands up. He goes, that's it, right? And we go, fuck yeah, that's it. Right, you know? So we were just like, just ecstatic. He just cracking up laughing that he just, you know, he just took a couple of my lines and just twisted them around because he knew exactly what he had to say. You know what I mean? You fucking cops. It was great, man.
It's perfect.
So the funniest thing was sometimes we'd be on the road and like our road manager or manager would go, hey, you know, Sam's over there playing that comedy club down the street, blah, 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 you know, or 5 miles away from you. They go, what? He is? They go, yeah. What time are you guys going? We go at 12. Well, Sam's off on 12. Next thing you know, he'd show up like before the end of the set or something. And sometimes he'd get up on stage with us and do his bit and kid goes wild, you know? So that was really cool. He was a really cool dude, man. But I tell you what, that guy could party anybody in the fucking table. You know, keep up with him. He was a madman.
And it's crazy because, I mean, you know, you hear the stories about him. And he passed away in a car accident, didn't he? It wasn't even like you assume it was the partying, and it wasn't. Like that's the tragedy beyond all tragedies.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is he was actually a preacher before he was a comedian. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Is that crazy?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
Baptist he's a preacher.
He certainly can talk. There's no question about that.
Oh, imagine.
Yeah.
But yeah, because I was reading about the video shoot that they did for the single on the album, and I mean it sounded completely
the
insane.
Roller Cop 2
the Sam Kinison.
Oh, for the Sam Kinison, the Under My Thumb.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The tragedy to me with that whole RoboCop thing that really, really super pissed me off. I mean, I was so fucking pissed off. The whole band was, but you know, they didn't want Sam on the record because he was on the video because he was swearing.
Yeah.
So you got the video going, the RoboCop guy running around, all shit, and there's just these sirens and stuff, and, oh, you cop, you know, whatever, you kid or something, a RoboCop says something. I'm like, man, this is just, jeez, you know. The song was a great song, and with Sam in it, it made it even better. But then when we did the RoboCop thing, it was like, oh, man, you know. Thinking to ourselves, what were we thinking, you know?
But when you're first offered, like your first, how did that happen? Did they first come to you? Like, you must have been excited at first. You're like, oh, RoboCop 2 is going to be huge. And, you know, have the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I mean, they end up,
yeah,
that
RoboCop
video
was
pretty much.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, RoboCop 1
RoboCop
was amazing.
RoboCop 2 was pretty cool.
Yeah.
the funny. So here's a backstory to that. That's really funny. So, you know, after they talk us into doing RoboCop 2, we're all excited. All right, let's do RoboCop 2, right? And Clive says, no matter what, we're going to release Desperate next. So we're like, all right, cool, fuck it. You know, because we've been waiting for our ballad to come out, because at the time, our ballads were pretty big, right? But it was like the record company didn't want us to pass up the opportunity to be, you know, have our song, trailer song, the trailer song of the movie, you know what I mean, which they were going to play on all the commercials and all that other kind of stuff. So they did the worldwide premiere here in San Francisco, right? And they send the band over there, and this guy gets up. The RoboCop guy that's supposed to be there, like Peter Weller, he doesn't show up, right?
Oh,
they
no.
have the RoboCop costume there, you know? So this guy that works for Arista, he gets in the RoboCop suit.
Oh,
no. Yeah. And we're sitting there, like, doing autographs and stuff, and we know it's this guy named Hilaire that works for the record company, and we're just like chuckling, laughing, going, this is just straight out of Spinal Tap. I mean, just right out of it, right?
And that so, is tremendous.
Then, okay, let's start the premiere of the movie, right? So the band goes in, and we sit in the very back, right? We got like our own row. We're sitting there, and we're watching the movie, and I swear about 25 minutes in, I said, oh my God, this fucking movie sucks. I'm thinking the whole time, oh man, this movie is not good. The first RoboCop 2 movie was good. This one's not good, you know.
Hey, look, compared to RoboCop 3, it was great.
Yeah, it was brilliant compared to that one. I know.
RoboCop 3 might be the worst movie ever.
They wanted, the funniest thing is they wanted us to do RoboCop 3 too.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, we go, no fucking way.
That's a good choice there,
you know. Yeah. They made the movie a couple years later, and they contacted us. Hey, did you guys think you guys want to do the RoboCop 2? A 3 movie with it? No way, man.
Yeah.
We would have just been known as a RoboCop fan the rest of our lives, right? You know?
Oh, you would have been the best thing in the movie, though. Like, no question about it.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
That's awesome. You know, it's also, I look at that RoboCop, that video, and I saw, like, the You Could Be Mine video from, with Terminator 2 and ZNR, and goddamn, they ripped off the entire concept.
That's one thing I hated about making videos, man. I swear, they give you treatments. There was this one treatment, man, they had in Bangle the Bells, they had us jumping around in a pinball game. Hit my balls and stuff like that. And that was a video shoot. And they were totally dead serious. I'm like, are you kidding me? We're inside of a pinball game and some kid's pulling the thing and these balls are hitting us and we're running from the balls and jumping over the flippers and shit. You know? I'm just like, there's just no way we could do this, right? And then here's the craziest thing. About 6 months later, my friends in Baton Rouge, they got the same treatment. The same exact one. And I don't know if you've ever seen their video, but that's their video.
Oh, I gotta watch it.
All the flippers and balls coming out of his stuff. I'm like, oh, you guys got sucked into that one.
Amazing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it is, man.
Because, you know, you would think that it would fit with a song instead of just being like, this is a treatment that we have to get to, that we have to get out. You know, this is such a great idea. We have to do this, no matter who it is.
So then they submitted the next idea, and all it is Wheel of Fortune, and I'm like, this is Wheel of Fortune, man. And the record company, well, no, it isn't. And I'm like, yeah, this is just Wheel of Fortune. What are you talking about? I mean, give me a break. So then I told my A&R guy, man, I said, let me just try and, like, because they were like, you're going to make this. They're basically saying, you're going to make this one. Clive really likes this one. Huh. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me, man. This is Royal Fortress. So I said, the only way we could do that is if we do this. You know, if we make the characters like it's the year 2020 or something, or 2050 or whatever, and we try to, and, you know, we get an atom bomb at the end for things they win and just make it really super dark and, you know, make it like it's futuristic, at least, you know what I mean, or something. So we kind of fooled with the script a little bit, and I am not lying, man. If you watch that video, at the very end, you see this big giant missile come on the script, I mean, on the scene, right? At the very last shot, I think we paid something like $6,500 for this damn missile, and this missile was as big as a house. Right? But they shot it in such a way that fucking missile was I mean, it just looked like a small little just toy. You know? It was like, let me get this thing. We rented this missile for $6,500 just at the end of the clip for like 3 seconds, and it looks like a little toy. Oh, man.
Oh.
It was crazy. And we were so disappointed in the when the video came out, the editing and stuff like that. We're like, oh, man. You know? But I'm sure everybody's gone through that musician-wise. You know, I've seen videos that are a lot worse. You know what I mean? But
there's some pretty bad ones out there, but it just seems it's crazy to think of that the songs are yours, so the vision should be yours. But no, the vision is the director or the you know, company or whatever, right?
Yeah. Hammer Swings Down, I was happy with. Everybody was happy with that one. You know, we felt it represented the band. You know, we were supposedly the band. We had all the hot chicks and stuff and the jail things, and you know, it kind of fit the song, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was embarrassing, you know. It was like really cool, you know. But then of course the next two videos are a little embarrassing, but you know, you gotta do what you gotta do back then.
You gotta do what you gotta do. Yeah, so
I'm just happy it wasn't Cherry Pie. It'd have been worse.
Oh, that's one of the cheesiest videos ever. But you know, it's so funny, it was so controversial at the time, and now it's so tame.
I know.
You know?
Things
change. Yeah, did you know those guys from Warrant? Did you know Janie Lane?
Not really. I mean, I had a couple friends that were real good friends with him, so sometimes we'd be at the same party, or I'd be at a dinner party, and he'd be there and stuff like that. Actually, he was a really cool guy and a really good songwriter. I actually think the stuff that he wrote with Warrant after they were off their major deal that you know, that was a little darker, I like that stuff a lot better, and I thought he sang it better. And it was
so
like, yeah. And I know he wasn't happy with Cherry Pie. He told me he wrote that song in like 5 minutes, just because he had a big argument with the record company. Like, he basically said, like, what, you want me to write something stupid like this? And they said, exactly. You know. So.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I think Ultraphobic and Belly to Belly volume one. Yeah, those are, you know, yeah, definitely that's some, there's some really cool shit in there for sure.
I know. Yeah, he was a good songwriter and good singer and good frontman too. You know, he just got pigeonholed, you know, at the beginning of his career, you know.
Yeah.
But everybody kind of does sometimes, because the record company's telling you what to do, and you're just a young kid. You're just like, oh, this is what everybody does, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's some stuff that we just wouldn't cross the line of. I got to tell you, that, to be honest with you, there was some stuff that was so fucking stupid. When we did the Hammer Swing Down video, they hired an aerobic coach and a dance coach. And they came down and put us in this auditorium. I'm not kidding you.
What?
And they started making us do laps, running around, and doing jumping jacks and shit like that. And I just said, this. We're making a rock video tomorrow night, and we're supposed to be, and these people are like coaching us like we're 10-year-olds or something. And I just walked over to my manager. I said, fuck, no fucking way. You know, no way. And all the guys in the band were like, oh man, what are we doing this for? You know, jumping jacks and running around and just trying to show us now. Shake your hair like this. Wiggle it around like this on this part and stuff. I was like, no fucking way. You know?
You can't make this up. Like, this is the stuff where we go, like, this is, you know, reality is crazier than anything you could write. Like, when I hear that story,
yeah,
that's unbelievable.
I think that flipping the hair thing might have been thought up by some kind of chubby old lady that used to be a dancer, because she was that shit. I was like, no! She's like, this is the way we just went, everybody got. That's not what he's doing.
I love it. Stage moves by, you know, like, by somebody else. Just like,
yeah, exactly. They want their little credit. They want their little credit in there, like, you know.
Oh, that's crazy.
Everybody's got to have their credit, you know.
And then they tell you what clothes to wear. They try to tell you what clothes to wear and all this kind of shit, you know. And you're like, God, yeah, you got to be freaking kidding me. I think that's why Guns N' Roses was so cool in a way, because they just said, fuck you guys all the time, no matter what. You know, they just wouldn't show up. You know, they just say, fuck you, you know. And we kind of had that same kind of attitude, you know what I mean? So we got a lot of slack from the record company that we weren't working with them and all this kind of shit. We're like, no, it's not that we're not working with you. We're just not going to do everything you say. We're not your fucking robot, you know? And that got us in a lot of trouble too, because when we released our second album, we had Psychedelic Sex Reaction on there, and we just said, we're not playing that song. It's just too damn corny. And, oh man, they fucking threw a shit fit, you know, because they flew out all these promoters, record radio promoters from everywhere, you know, and we were playing Chicago somewhere, and our manager came out and he said, "You're going to play Psychedelic Sex Reaction, right?" And we go, "No." She's like, "You, what are you talking about? Aerosmith just spent $50,000 flying out all these promoters just to see you, you know, play this song." They made a box. Aerosmith, for promotional purposes, Aerosmith made a box, and inside the box it said Psychedelic Sex Reaction. And I had condoms that were like, "Have psychedelic love." How to have psychedelic sex. Like a little book, a candy cane that said Psychedelic Sex Reaction on it. All this fucking shit, you know. You're like, oh my God, this is crazy. You spend all that money, right? And we got up on stage, man. And we just tore through our set like for about an hour and 15 minutes. And, you know, all the radio programmer dudes are there. And I think they're all waiting for us to play Psychedelic Sex Reaction. And bam, we get off the stage and go back to our dressing room. And our manager comes in, he just starts screaming. He's a New York guy. He's just screaming like, "You motherfuckers, you fucking ruined your career. What were you thinking? They spent thousands of dollars on this song and you don't even play it." Me and my drummer go, "Ah, fuck you, Jay. Go get a beer." We go, "We know it could be an end of our career, but at the same time, it would be worse if that song became a hit and we were known for that the rest of our lives." You know?
Well, that would have been your cherry pie.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly.
Imagine the video they would have had for that with Golden.
I can't believe that they thought that was the video. Like, that was the single. Like how does that song even get written?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, how did,
oh, no.
How did, who wrote it?
Yeah. So, well, what happened was Jack Pawney and Randy Jackson wrote the song, right?
Oh.
And Clive Davis heard it, and he goes, "Oh, I love this song, Psychedelic Sex Reaction." He just really loved the title. Right? He calls me up. He calls me up, and I'm in Hollywood. He's in New York. He calls me up. He's like, "Eric, I have a hit song for you that I want you to do, but I need you to change the lyrics and make it more modern, and just, you know, but I want you to keep the title and the melody and everything else, but I want you to try to change some of the lyrics." And I said, "Oh shit, okay. Well, you know, Clive's never been wrong before. I don't think really, except for a couple times, right?" So he sends me the song. I go, "Oh no, I can't do this song." You know, how am I going to tell him? So I call him back up, you know, get his office secretary. "Can I talk to Clive, please? It's Dirk Davis, Battling Beaches." "Okay, hold on a minute." "Oh, he'll call you back an hour or whatever." So he called me back. And I said, "Clive, man, we just can't do this song." And him and I must have talked on the phone for 2 hours. And he was like, by the end of our conversation, because I tell him every reason I could think of why it just wasn't a ballet song, you know. By the end of our conversation, he said, "Look, Derek," he goes, "bottom line," after he goes through his whole spiel, of course, "I signed Janis Joplin, I signed Santana, I signed," you know what I mean? Like, telling me all his credibility, which I already know, but he's like hammering home, like, "You dumb shit, you're just a, you know, you're just a fucking kid playing guitar and singing, you know? So do what I say," he was basically telling me, you know? Anyway, so he just says, "If you don't put this song on the next record, the record isn't going to come out till you find another, a bigger hit song that I think is a bigger hit song." And I just went, "Oh my God, we could be writing this record for another 6 months. Who knows?" You know? So we decided to tune it down, like drop it a key, make it a little bit more heavier. And then we recorded the song. And as soon as we were done with it, we all put our hands in the pot, you know, together in the recording studio. And we all vowed that we would never, ever play that song again live, no matter what. We were only doing it just to get our record out, and we put it on the record. And that was it, right? And so, of course, you know, 8 months later, they want to release it as a single. You know, and we're all looking at each other like, "Nope, we ain't never playing that song. They can release this single if they want." So that basically kind of ended our career, to be honest with you. I mean, we were in nice buses and stuff like that up to then, and I swear, 2 weeks later, we were in a Winnebago.
No shit. You're kidding. You're kidding.
Oh, man. No, they just pulled all the tour support, and they just basically said, "Fuck you. If you're not going to work with us, we ain't working with you." Yep.
Well, there's like a good seven, like I say, it's not as good an album as the first album, but there's like seven songs on that album, at least, better than Psychedelic Sex.
I agree.
It doesn't roll off the tongue. Nobody's going to sing that, you know?
I don't know what he was thinking, you know? I don't know. And if it's such a great hit, how come it become a hit for somebody else? Because after that, they tried to shop it to people, and I don't know anybody that's done it except for Randy Jackson.
Yeah, you know? Well, there you go. So how is it that you managed to, you're in there and you're all the parties and the craziness and the strip, how is it you kind of managed to avoid some of the pitfalls of excess and that some other people and you know, some of your peers kind of couldn't avoid?
Well, you know, even my band members, they had a lot of pitfalls. You know, I really never did. I mean, there was a lot of times where I just picked up cocaine, you know, dishes and just threw them out the window right in front of everybody in the band. I said, what are you going to do about it? Basically knew that I was pretty anti-drug, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't care if they smoked pot, stuff like that, but when they started dabbling in heavier drugs and shit like that, you know, especially when we had a show right before a show or something like that, and, you know, I was like, no, man, that ain't going to happen, you know? And I pretty much, you know, I got a good publishing deal advance and stuff like that, so I pretty much, you know, set myself up in a nice house and just kind of, yeah, I was writing songs a lot, you know? The rest of the guys were partying day and night. Well, I didn't have to party day and night anymore because I had a publishing advance and I had money to go buy my own house and stuff, you know what I mean? So I kind of removed myself from that, you know? When we weren't on the road, I was writing songs and things like that and, you know, doing other stuff, but I wasn't, you know, just doing drugs all the time with, like, some of the most guys probably do, you know, that we're known for anyway. So,
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that some people think they're supposed to. Like, they think they're not being a rock star unless they're partying and doing the cocaine and the different stuff, you know?
Yeah. I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you then really quickly. Number one, if we have, if we were to throw a couple songs then on at the end, what songs would you like us to put on? Do we have permission to do that?
Yeah, what, from Babylon AD?
Yeah, or from whatever you want.
Anything you like.
Well, it's got to be yours. I mean, don't put Aerosmith on.
Do you guys have a Revolt album?
You bet. Yeah.
You know, what's really a cool song on that album is Hollywood Heartbreak.
Nice. Okay. Great. We'll throw that
on
there.
That's a cool rocker tune.
So I got to ask you then. Go ahead. Are you a Raiders fan?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I figured. So there you are. And number one, what do you think of the season? And number two, what do you think of the movie?
I hope they don't move. You know, it looks like they will, but I hope they don't. But I'll still be a Raiders fan no matter what. I think they're going to have a good season this year, man. I think they picked up some really good key players, and I hope that Marshall Lynch kicks some ass like he used to. You know, if he can do what he used to do, man, it's going to be crazy. Because Carr's fourth year now, I think it is?
Yeah.
He's ready and prime now. You know, he's just as good as any quarterback or better than probably 75-80% of people in the league now. I think this year might be, you know, probably playoff year, but who knows, might get the Super Bowl. I don't know, but they're going to be really tough this year. You know?
Nice. Yeah, I see them as that team that seems to be the most likely team to knock off the Pats in the AFC right now to me.
Yeah, they seem really hungry. Like, they got shit to prove. You know, a lot of teams, they've already been to Super Bowls and things, and they're just great players, but they don't have to be hungry anymore. These guys are, like, they're still in their early 20s, and, Khalil Mack's been there. I mean, they've played together for a while now as a team. You know, the young guys came up, you know, and now it's like, man, I could tell that they're just itching, you know.
All right, Brett, you have anything last, or are we going to give them a chance to do your final plugs?
Well, I got tons of stuff. I do want to really just quickly. So Desperate, it was crazy to me when I heard it on the Baton Rouge, on the first Baton Rouge album. Or was it number one or number two, whichever one. But so is that because you were friends or did Jack take that with him?
Well, what happened with that was, you know, our record, we were starting to make our second record, and it never became a hit for us because they never released it. And I always thought it was a hit. And Jack Pawnee called me up. He said, and he was producing Baton Rouge's album. And he said, hey, do you mind if we put this record on Desperate on Baton Rouge's album? I said, well, I got nothing to lose, right? Shit. You know, if it became a hit, at least I get 50% writer's credit, you know? So they put that on their album. I don't know if it did any good for them or not. I don't really see too much royalty, so I guess not.
Well, you had it on Revolt too. What's the reason for putting it on that album too?
Because I wanted to do it again. I wanted to do it the way that I would do it, you know, and sing it a little bit different and stuff. I thought when I sang it in the recording studio the first time that it was way too. It was just really super hard to sing that song in the studio when I was with Simon Anbar because he made me sing no shit, one word at a time.
What?
I'm not kidding you. So it sounded like a damn, to me it always sounded like a robot. I could sing a sentence like, here we sit in this smoky one, whatever, you know. But yeah, he'd say, just say here. Just say sit. Just say smoky. And he just pieced it together like it was some kind of jigsaw. And I was just, it just drove me freaking nuts when I'd listen to the song back because it was so emotionless to me. You know what I mean?
Now I got to listen to that again because I think now I'll pick that up.
It's, if you, yeah, you probably pick it up. If you listen to the first record and then you listen to the one I did, you go, oh shit, Derek's singing way better now.
I did prefer
half the song, you know?
Yeah, I did prefer that one. I preferred live versions. I preferred every other version, but I wasn't sure why. Now I get it. You know, that's an interesting story,
too.
Too
stale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you know what? You're about to run out of power, and it's too bad because we're having a
blast.
So you've given us plenty of your time, so we just want to thank you for coming on, Derek. You know.
Well, thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it. I'm really happy that you guys are knowledgeable on your music, and you guys are still rocking and still got it going on, man. That's awesome.
Oh, you betcha.
And so one more time, plug everything, and let me tell you something. We're not going to see you this year. And I'm hoping 2018 you'll be in the Monsters of Rock Tour because we plan to be on that, or on the cruise.
I'm sorry, I missed that part. What did you say?
I said we're hoping in 2018 you'll be on the Monsters of Rock cruise because we're planning to be there. And we'll come shake your hand.
Oh, I don't know. We've got some dates in, coming up here. A couple of dates in Germany, a couple of dates in England. And then we're playing our record release party out here in California in November, so or in October. So, we'll see. I don't know.
We'll see what 2018 holds, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet. You know, Larry hasn't gotten a hold of me, so I don't know if we're going to play it or not.
Okay, sounds good. Well, no matter what, we're going to find a way to come out there and shake your hand and thank you for the interview at some point. Because, this is great. We really appreciate it. So, one more time, plug your shit.
What would you like me to say?
What would you like to plug? When is the date? When's the new album coming out? Where do they get it?
Okay. The new album, Babylon AD, Revelation Highway, comes out November 10th. There will be pre-orders. If you go to frontiersrl.com, you can probably pre-order it from there. Or you could probably pre-order from our website, babylonad.com. And if anybody wants to know more about us, you can check us out on Facebook, babylonad.com, or go to babylonad.com and see the dates that we've got set up coming up and just read news about us and learn a little bit more about the band. And hopefully we'll see any of the true diehard rock and roll fans that are still following Babylon AD out on tour. We look forward to that.
Well, that's awesome. Well, Derek Davis, we wish you all the best in the future. And thank you so much for coming on. We totally appreciate it.
Thank you, brothers. Thank you. Good talking to you guys.